You're listening to Retronauts, a part of the Greenlit Podcast Network, a collective of creator-owned and fully independent podcasts focused on pop culture and video gaming. To learn more and to catch up on all the other network shows, check out greenlitpodcasts.com. This week in Retronauts, yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, recording remotely from North Carolina with the usual madmen over there. I am the John McClane to this podcast, and downstairs on the floor of the Nakatomi building, the plaza, we have...
Hey, it's Bob Mackey, and I am the Mr. Falcon of this podcast.
You're not the Reginald Val Johnson?
I wish I could be as cool as him, but in case you're wondering, that was what they dubbed Motherfucker with in the TV version. Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon. With a guy that sounds nothing like Bruce Willis.
And hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and these Twinkies are for my wife, okay?
And yes, we are talking about Die Hard. That's German for the hard. The story of Officer Die Hard running around inside a Japanese building in Los Angeles, trying to stop British terrorists who sound German, pretending to be American. It's very confusing. It's extremely international. And it is also, I think, the third in this kind of informal series that Bob and Henry and I have going, where we're talking about films that inspired video games in the late 80s, but also kind of redefined how violence was presented on screen in movies and really kind of changed the sort of baseline of what was acceptable in Hollywood in terms of, mainstream violence and not so much with Die Hard. It's not as violent as some of the others we talked about, like Running Man and definitely not RoboCop. But there is definitely some kind of frank violence here. It's central to the story, but also a lot of language, very salty language that would not have been in vogue 5 years earlier than that. And in a way, this is kind of a continuation of the series that I've been doing with the Retronauts East Gang, which, you know, is about other movies from the 80s that inspired video games and kind of became tentpoles of pop culture, such as Star Wars and, of course, Indiana Jones. I really feel like Die Hard owes a great debt to a lot of things, but John McClane, the central hero, the Bruce Willis character, who's the protagonist here, really, really, I don't think would have existed as he is without Indiana Jones to sort of pave the way. Because Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford, gave a performance where he was heroic and dashing and cool, but also kind of a little bit of a klutz and very vulnerable, and playing off that vulnerability and humanity made him a much more compelling character. And that's definitely the case with Die Hard. John McClane is very, very much, a one-man, not a one-man army. It's not a Schwarzenegger movie, although Arnold Schwarzenegger was courted for the part. I think it would have been a very different and much worse movie if he had been it. But Bruce Willis presented him as a guy who was in way over his head and doing his best to make to survive basically a terrible situation and help prevent other innocent people from being killed. And he takes a beating throughout the movie, and that's very, very central to the character. And it's why most of the Die Hard sequels really suck, because they just completely abandoned that, especially the most recent two. Die Hard, Live Free, Die Hard, Die Another Day. I don't know. I don't even care enough about those movies because I've seen them and they're bad. And they just completely missed the entire point of what this movie is and what made John McClane different than the typical Hollywood hero. And, as a result, this is a really great movie that I think holds up really well now. I'll be curious to hear from our podcast guests who had not seen it until recently. Big surprises there. I won't spoil who that is. But I am curious to hear that perspective. But I feel like this is a movie I can still watch and still really empathize with the protagonist and really find myself invested in the story, because it's really well written and very well acted. And it's very just like a nicely crafted action movie that was very, very influential. And also, because this is Retronauts, inspired some really crappy video games.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So guys, what is your history with Die Hard? Henry, how about you?
Oh, well, I didn't see it until I got it on VHS in like 1997, I think. I remember it was like the Fox Selects collection or whatever was on the VHS box. And but I watched it because my friends who were super into action films are like, it's time for you to grow up and stop watching your PG-13 action films and watch this very dirty one. And yeah, I mean, I loved it the first time I saw it, you know, as teen boys, a lot of them would, because it's just loud and sweary and blood everywhere, and you've got a cool dude as the main character. But, you know, as time went on, I think it wasn't one I celebrated, I think, in definitely an action movie snob kind of way, because I'm like, well, if you like this, you should really like Jackie Chan movies. Or actually, you know, Hard Boiled takes the same kind of story and makes it even better. Like, I would have said those things, and I still believe those. But but coming back to it now, I'm like, wow, this is even better than I remembered, because I just remembered the fireworks factory at the end. I didn't remember, like, the kind of hour plus of character building the movie takes to earn that trip to the fireworks factory. And I guess one last thing I'd add is to your Indiana Jones thing, I think you're totally right. Especially in that I remember the scene in Indiana Jones and the Raiders where he is just in bed in pain and he's like, oh, mm-hmm. It really hurts to have done. He says, it's not the years, it's the miles, baby. Mm. Like, and so that was them showing a scene that, like, James Bond in movies up to that point would not have had a moment where he's like, oh, I tore my rotator cuff or whatever. And
I need some ice.
And that's what McClane goes through in this. Even more than Dr. Jones does.
Yeah, his kind of defining vulnerability in the movie is the fact that he took off shoes because he's afraid of flying, which makes sense in the context of the story. But because of his barefootedness, you know, that's something that the villains are able to use against him and something that he has to overcome and kind of work through. So, Bob, what about you?
This is the first time I've seen this movie.
What?
Yes.
And what did you think?
I loved it, of course. It's very good.
Oh, good.
Yes, I did like it a lot.
I can't believe you've never seen Die Hard.
It's because of people like you, Henry. No, Die Hard is one of those movies that when you're in your 20s, all of your male friends aggressively proselytize. So I kind of didn't see it just to piss them off. It was like, I didn't see Goodfellas until I was 25 because of these people. Just like, it's for a bad reason. It's for, you know, the fans are annoying. But now I'm getting over that and finally seeing these movies that were pushed on me too hard. And yes, I loved it. It's a great movie, very economical, very smart. And I had to wonder, like, while watching all of these, like, brutal killings and violence and swearing, all the, concerned parents of the 80s, I wonder how they would think today, knowing this film is celebrated as, like, a smart, intelligent piece of cinema.
Well, as you mentioned the brutality, I do think that is something worth addressing, because we did an episode of What a Cartoon about the TV series The Max. And one of the episodes of The Max, based on one of the issues of the comic, sees The Max being chased by, I don't remember, it's like a shark or something. I can't remember exactly what because it was a Savage Dragon character named Mako. And I can't remember what they changed it to in the cartoon. But anyway, the running dialogue in Max's mind throughout that, it's actually not in Max's mind, sorry. It's Mr. Gon's running dialogue over the action is like, oh, this is the part where the hero gets his back against the wall and he finally gets to, you know, lash out in justified violence. And you're just waiting for this because it's so exciting and he's earned it. It's not just gratuitous. It's something that he deserves because the villain is so bad and he's been just pounded on for so long, right? And I really feel like this is kind of the embodiment of that the basically built-in media criticism from The Max. Because if you watch, you know, at the beginning of the movie, John McClane is a cop and he tries to play by cop rules, as they say. And, you know, he's trying to subdue armed international terrorists with machine guns and, you know, arrest them or basically prevent them non-lethally from carrying out their actions. And the first kill that he causes in the movie is completely accidental. He accidentally knocks one of the terrorists down a stairwell, which breaks the guy's neck.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something he deliberately intended to do. But the further you get into the movie, the more pissed off he gets, and the more he's just like whipping out his guns and, you know, kicking people off window ledges and stuff like that. And in fact, the kind of big resolution for the movie, sort of the coda, is that the cop who accidentally killed a kid and doesn't want to use guns is like, I'm finally cool enough and brave enough and sure enough in myself that I can shoot down a man with my own gun. So there is a real celebration of violence here, yeah. But like in a justified way.
It's okay
to be super violent and mean and you know, just brutal because they earned it.
I definitely saw that too, Jeremy. There's like a sense of karma to the murders in this movie, where what really underlines it is that the hacker is not murdered at mm-hmm. the end of the movie. He's punched out by the limo driver, but not murdered. And everyone that is murdered was trying to murder him. He's not Nathan Draking his way around the building and snapping necks, but people just standing around.
I think of so many movies, action movies, where they have to have some line by a character to let you know that, like, oh, this person's a really bad person, so it's okay, you don't have to feel bad at all. But in this movie, the way they talk through, like, the ethics of his existence is really interesting to me in this viewing, because I definitely know it was a general trope of 80s action films and going forward other ones, well, 70s too, but cop action films in America, a huge part of them, like say even Dirty Harry, are the rules are really holding back cops from taking down the bad guys.
Mm-hmm, and it's just Death Wish.
Death Wish. All these ones make it so clear of like, if the cops didn't have so many rules, they could do stuff. Like even RoboCop had that too. Like, hey, Mr. Cop, can't stop me. I got all these rules. And in this case too, the first guy he points a gun at, he's like, oh, you're a cop, you have rules, you can't kill me. And then the guy on top of the table who's shooting at him and shooting at him the whole time, he's like, when you have a chance to kill somebody, you should. And then McClane just fucking blasts him. And
right in the groin.
And he says, good advice, which is just like, yeah, he says, I need to be a terrorist. I have to be a terrorist to fight terrorists and not give a crap about the rules.
Well, now the cops don't have rules in life. How is that working out for everyone?
I feel safer than ever.
This movie does have some baggage in 2020. Yeah.
Well, and also, I think, too, I'd forgotten about this scene where after McClane kills another guy, I think it's the thrown out the window. No. It's when the cokehead gets shot. They have to have a scene with Reginald Val Johnson and his boss going like, no, he couldn't have done anything. We should not be mad at John McClane. He did his best to save that guy. He didn't kill this guy. Like it's Reginald as an audience insert. I think he's telling you ethically, like, you can't blame John McClane. It's not his fault.
Right. And That's kind of one of my big complaints about the movie, not Sergeant Al Powell, who is great, but the fact that for some of this to work and for some of this exposition to come out, you have to have like the chief of police just be the stupidest moron on the planet. To see the FBI guy. No, the FBI guy is the Fratelli brother.
Johnson and Johnson.
Yeah. I love Johnson and Johnson. They're like true sociopaths.
Oh,
they're,
for sure. Yeah. Like, oh yeah, 20% of the hostages will die. That's fine. Let's go.
Yeah, it's that's ripped from the headlines. So I do think that there needs to be, like, it requires a little bit of suspension of disbelief. Like, would the chief of police really be that stupid? Would the media really be that stupid to, like, immediately rush to the house and give away the identity of the hero cop in there? Like, maybe, but I just feel like, yeah, there's a lot of kind of stupidity piling up. And I feel like that's all kind of tied to one of the underlying themes that's running throughout the movie. And I don't know if it's deliberate, but there's so much of it that even if it's not an intentional, deliberate message, you know, that the writers put in, it's definitely something baked into their worldview. And that is traditional American masculinity versus, you know, the effete. I mean, if you look at John McClane, he is a red-blooded American male. He's a New York East Coast cop. He smokes cigarettes and he drinks whiskey and he doesn't trust airplanes. Mm-hmm. And he's going out to L.A., California with all the granola and the yoga and the hippies.
Yeah.
Where his wife has moved to LA, which is just like, you know, the corrupt capital of America. It's the entertainment industry. And she's chasing her own career independently of their home and splitting apart their family to the point that she has taken back her maiden name professionally.
Mm, gasp.
And
she's working for a Japanese corporation that's bought out not just real estate in Los Angeles, but actually the executive boardroom is Lloyd Wright's Falling Water House. Like the iconic piece of American architecture. The idea there was that they bought this house and installed it in the executive boardroom of this skyscraper. Meanwhile, you know, John just wants to go see his kids, and he takes a limo, which, you know, he's never been in a limo before, because that's decadent. Mm-hmm. And the driver is a young African-American kid, and his Christmas music is by Run DMC. It's just crazy. Meanwhile, his wife is being wooed by a cokehead idiot who's all like, let's go have some mulled wine and some brie, and I'll do some lines of coke and give you a Rolex. So yeah, there's definitely like this whole, you know, we can't let go of the traditional American manhood, folks. We're under attack here in the late 80s, going into the 90s. We've got to take it back, even if that means killing some Germans along the way.
Yeah, I noticed in the beginning of the movie all the California scoffing he does. I thought was very funny because I live in California. I'm not from here. But also in the movie, he is weakened by California because he follows the frou-frou California guy's advice by taking his shoes off and balling up his feet. Yeah. And that's why he has no shoes on for the movie, because he followed that weak Californian's advice.
You're right. He intentionally weakened himself by listening to this California bullshit that this guy
was putting. But his homeopathic remedy did work. He made fist with his toes. Son of a bitch, it works.
You're talking about American masculinity, Jeremy. I think there are some interesting like World War II analogies to be made here, because like the Axis powers are working against Bruce Willis in this movie. Mm-hmm. Like the building is working against him, that's Japanese, and the terrorists are, you know, German.
Yes. Yeah.
For the most part.
All this German.
And and then, you know, the FBI guy who's flying around in the helicopter, he played one of the Fratelli brothers in The Goonies. That's Italian. Mm-hmm. So you got the whole axis right there.
That's true. Yeah. She even says like, well, it's a Japanese company. I needed to change my name. It's like, okay, sure.
That's the opposite of how it works, actually.
Well, and also not only that, but the mother has sold out her motherhood as well by hiring a nanny. Like someone else is raising her kids, not her.
Or just by having a job. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the first place.
Yeah. I mean, it makes it worse in that regard from an American traditional values view of things. I'm not saying personally I think it makes it worse. But yeah, he's just, John McClane is this force of just orders. Like, I just got this common sense stuff, man. I know it all. And also, I mean, his love of 50s Western stars, like that's as traditional American values as you could get there.
But despite all of this baggage that we've discussed for the past 15 minutes, I still really love this movie. It is just a masterclass in narrative, in plotting, in just direction. One of the things I love about it is that it's almost what, you know, in television would be called a bottle episode, where it takes place almost entirely in or immediately around a single location. You get the, you know, the setup on the airplane and LAX and the limo, and you get occasional shots out to like a TV studio or the McClane household for some extra context. But for the most part, it does take place within this one building. And I think, you know, my love for that sort of thing comes from the same place as my love for Metroidvania games, where it's just, I love, you know, having this kind of self-contained narrative where there is real geometry or geology or geography or whatever. I don't know, like just a real sense of place, mise-en-scene or something. I don't know. But it feels like they're really making use of the actual internal logistics of this building. Every place that you see, you understand where it is in relation to the other places, and you understand how everyone is moving around in relationship to one another and how all the parts kind of fit together. And, you know, to me, that is a really great way to tell a story is to make sure that there is kind of this internal logic, this internal consistency to where people are. You lose a lot of that in kind of modern action films. It hasn't been so bad recently, but you know, in like the early 2000s, 2010s, it was really bad, you know, because of the influence of the Bourne legacy and or Bourne, whatever, the Bourne agenda, whatever, the Bourne movies, basically, yes. Where it's just like hyperactive cameras, constant cuts, you know, that replaced actual sort of staging and, you know, real cohesive direction. And I hate when movies do that. And it's much more interesting to me when you actually get a feel of like, where is everyone? Like, where are all these things happening?
Yeah.
You know, how are they using this location against each other? And because there's such a cat and mouse element to this movie, especially, I think it's really important. And, you know, because John McClane is so vulnerable, I think kind of painting a picture and making this place seem real not only raises the stakes, but also kind of grounds it and makes you kind of understand, like, here's the places he's got to move. Here's the challenges to get in his way. Here's why he has to take the air ducts for this one part, even though it really sucks. And, you know, you see him go back to places or, you know, places kind of show up that you've previously seen just in kind of passing. And it's very satisfying. Like the building, I wouldn't say it's the character, but it definitely, it really does lend the movie a sense of not reality, but authenticity, I guess would be the word.
Yeah, even if you don't like the themes of the movie, you could look at them ironically, of course, as we are sort of doing. But I do think the screenplay is very, very good and tight and mechanical in a way, in a positive way, where you could say, well, this is very artificial because everything pays off. Everybody gets a moment. And it's like a Sid Field 101, how to write a screenplay, screenplay. But it's kind of fun to watch a movie-ass movie. If you're a fan of like order and organization, seeing how everything just pays off so cleanly and neatly, just like you said, Jeremy, it's so satisfying to your brain, especially because this weekend we're also recording a podcast about a movie that's very muddy and not very satisfying and not very clean. You could see how in some cases you could be like, well, you can try to be more experimental, but at times it's fun when people stick to the movie-ass movie structure. Mm-hmm. It's so satisfying.
Oh, I like looking at it like a Swiss watch or whatever. You just like, look at all these wheels turning in place. It all goes where it's supposed to. Every line explains something. Thing. Like, no, the story, just for example, Reginald L. Johnson's story about why he has a desk job now, like that touches you. It makes you care about this character who's just another voice on a line for McClane. But then it pays off in like this gigantic way at the end of the movie. And it's just so many lines like that, yeah, that just explain everything. And when everything is just so nonsensical in movies now. And I think too, I will say visceralness of the movie. Like it feels like something, I know there's fake shots in this movie and I know they use blue screen and all these things, but it does, a lot of the shots feel very different from watching a Marvel movie or a Transformers movie where literally everything feels fake and created around them. Like, there, it at least feels like, oh, that is a real chain clanging around when he grabs a chain and wraps it around a guy's throat.
Yeah, Bruce Willis, he's in good shape, but not, he's in good 80s shape. He's not like the giant thumb he is today.
Yeah.
So
it's an attainable body type,
yeah.
I think. Die Hard One John McClane,
right, as opposed to the Kumail Nanjiani, you know what they did to me to make me in a Marvel movie? Yeah. It hurts. I don't want to be like this.
I miss pizza. I haven't had pizza in 18 months. Yeah.
Stop torturing our celebs.
You mentioned a clock or Swiss watch like precision, and that's spot on, although, you know, they're German, not Swiss. But I do feel like this sort of mechanical, mechanistic nature of the story really reinforces the genius of the villains. Like, you know, Alan Rickman's character, Hans Gruber, is an evil genius. And he has plotted out this incredibly elaborate scheme to just get rich, down to the second, basically. And John McClane is this agent of chaos running around, you know, the fly in his ointment, basically, you know, the spanner in his works, whatever you want to say. He's just making a mess of all of Gruber's plans. So there is this like push and pull tension between the two of them who only meet in person twice. It's kind of got a Wrath of Khan sort of thing going on there where, you know, they're basically playing off each other, and Gruber is constantly sort of, you know, you see the wheels spinning in his head as he tries to calculate, like, okay, we've lost access to this, or this bad thing has happened, but we can still pull this off because I've accounted for, you know, the possibility of something to go wrong here. And so that's one of the interesting things about the script to me, is that even though John McClane is badly outnumbered the entire time, he does have the advantage over the villains in that there's only one of him and he's not tied to an organization. Mm. He can just be anywhere he wants to be, you know, as long as he's able to get there. He doesn't have to, you know, pull off a plan perfectly. He just has to prevent their plan from being pulled off perfectly. And so he gets the upper hand a few times throughout the film. You know, he gets the detonators, which completely undermines their scheme. And so, yeah, I feel like the sort of very precise nature of the plotting and, you know, the sort of setting really kind of reinforces the sense of, like there is a master plan here. And John McClane is working against that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they show how resourceful McClane is so many times. It's really in smart ways that you're just like, you know, obviously no one could stop a group of terrorists in this way in reality. But at the very least, you're like, well, you know, I could imagine a guy could sit on top of an elevator and, yeah, he'd find a Sharpie somewhere and he'd write down the names on his arm. Like, I get that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, the film works in a lot of ways because, one, it shows that the villains are diabolical, cruel, but not stupidly cruel. Like, Gruber is willing to make accommodations for the lady who's been taken hostage and is, you know, pregnant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, send people to the bathroom so they don't pee all over the floor. So, you know, he's not a sociopath. He's just, you know, very greedy. Mm-hmm. And very amoral. But at the same time, you know, he's very, very smart. And John McClane is not smart in the same way, but he has, you know, years of kind of being a street cop under his belt and is able to sort of improvise and kind of work around and make the most of what he's given. Mm. And it makes a very, very satisfying story.
Well, there's a funny thing in the making of things. So the Movies That Made Us, I'm sourcing that as the Netflix documentary series, which, you know, it is light. It is like a VH1 style documentary, so it's not like the most in depth. But they interviewed a lot of the real people who worked on this, including the director. And there was a funny point he made about how in the script they had originally, it was just terrorists, and he turned it down because he's like, just terrorists. I don't like terrorists. And so he eventually made it, convince him, like, no, make them robbers who pretend to be terrorists, because terrorists bring people down. It's just a bummer. But if they're pretending to be terrorists just to rob stuff, like, people like robbers. Robbers are cool. So it was a smart move on their part. I love how Hans, when he's calling for all of the freeing of terrorists, he's just like, I read about them in Time magazine. Like,
they're all unrelated groups.
Yeah.
All right, so we've kind of jumped straight into the discussion of themes and meaning and that sort of thing without giving a lot of setup. But Die Hard, 1987 movie, was pretty successful. It was in development for a long time, apparently, and it was actually built around a novel from the 1970s called Nothing Lasts Forever, which I've never read. I don't know if you guys know anything about that.
I know a bit about that. Yeah, from the doc. But
yeah, I just know that all the Die Hard movies are based on different sources, yeah. So there's no consistent, like, John McClane book series or whatever.
So in the 60s, some guy, I forget his name, but he wrote the author of the second book. This is a sequel novel. He did a book called The Detective. Live, which was
great name.
It was, yeah, which was then made into a film starring Frank Sinatra. And the film did well, and Frank Sinatra wanted to keep playing this character, so he told that guy to write a sequel novel that then he'd make into a sequel movie. And it took the guy over a decade to write that sequel novel.
That's right.
And in the book, it's a 60-year-old man stuck in a building trying to save his daughter, who at the end of it, she falls to her death. And you watch like a 60-year-old man drop his 40-year-old daughter to her death, and it's a giant bummer. So, and they still thought, though, it would really work as a film. But Frank Sinatra had first right of refusal because it was his movie, basically. But by the time it was time to start filming, he was like 62, and he's like, I don't want to do this.
I can't imagine Frank Sinatra crawling through the ducts.
No. I kind of want to see it, though. I kind of want to see it.
Oh, baby, this is tough.
And Sammy Davis Jr. as Al Wilson, or whatever his name is.
All right, so the movie stuck around in development for a long time. Eventually, the script for this, the final script, was written by a guy named Jeb Stuart, who had no credits under his belt, and Stephen D'Souza, had like every action movie of the 80s under his belt. 48 Hours, Commando, Jumpin' Jack Flash, The Running Man, and he would go on to write Street Fighter.
And direct it.
So he is like the nexus of 80s action scripts. So he wrote this one and did a bang up job. And then they tried to cast different leads and like offered this to basically every male in Hollywood, including Schwarzenegger, Harrison Ford, Harry Dean Anderson. And finally,
MacGyver.
Finally, everyone turned it. Yeah, MacGyver. Everyone turned it down. And so they finally offered it to Bruce Willis. And because he was currently starring in the TV series Moonlighting, and it was on a hiatus because Sybil Shepherd was pregnant, he was like, yeah, sure, why not? I'll have a few laughs. I'm sure his Bruno album didn't do that well. So he was like, yeah, I could use some extra scratch. And
he was advertising.
A legacy was born.
He was advertising Seagram's to make a little extra money.
Oh, man.
Oh, that ad.
That is bottom tier right there.
Yeah, I was only 6 when this movie was happening, and I was not aware of all the Hollywood hubbub. But, you know, in retrospect, I've read that, you know, he was a controversial choice. He was like the sitcom-y guy. But in retrospect, it was a great choice. I mean, the movie's great. He's great in it. It's a great choice because he has to be alone for like 80% of the movie and carry all the scenes alone. Mm-hmm. And he has enough charisma to do that, to just like be able to talk to himself essentially and carry scenes.
Yeah, he's great with the quips in this. I mean, yes, the script is strong because that's where the quips come from, but he sells them in a totally different way than Schwarzenegger would. Like Schwarzenegger, he doesn't have any self-effacement whatsoever. Whereas a big part of this is McClane kind of like beating himself up for like, what the hell did you get into? Why are you doing this, you moron? You're going to get yourself killed. But, you know, he's just driving forward because there's no other choice. It's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And yeah, it really, really makes him a likable, sympathetic character.
You would not see Arnold Schwarzenegger in Commando going like, oh man, I'm so scared of jumping off this building. Oh, God help me. Like you never see that, but it just feels so, so real for McClane. Well, also D'Souza, it was Jeb Stuart wrote the script first, and they said they kept all his action beats, but they're like, we need D'Souza to beef this up comedy wise like this needs to be funnier. And so he apparently was like rewriting up to the last minute of just new lines and one-liners for Willis to say.
These are better one-liners than The Running Man. I like those for how dumb they are. Like sub zero now plane zero or whatever that was.
Well, Running Man and Commando, they both like heavily deliver these lines of like a stand-up comic who's like, well, maybe that's just Arnold's style of delivery, but he's like, I will stand in place and say a silly line. But but Bruce Willis plays it much more natural when he's doing his silly ass dialogue.
Yeah, like the first time he does his yippee-ki-yay motherfucker line, which becomes, you know, kind of the iconic line, like the line that shows up in every movie. He's kind of smirking to himself, smoking a cigarette, and sort of goofily backing out of a room through a door as he says it. It's not like you know, stand-up comedy timing. It's not that kind of delivery. It's more like he's making a little joke to himself that just happens to be broadcast to a villain on a CB, and he's very amused by his own joke.
Yeah,
but not in like a I am so funny way. It's just like a
yeah. I would think Arnold in an Arnold movie or a Stallone movie, like they would have had like a zoom in on their face at like shouting into the CB radio or into the walkie-talkie, yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. But instead, it's
but in this case, he's actually vanishing from the camera's view.
Yeah, yeah.
I was surprised to see the line in that context.
Well, because
it wasn't like a triumphant line. It was like, but this line might work. Goodbye.
They play it so big in all the other diehards that I'd forgotten how normally and like naturally this was played in this scene.
Yeah, and it's a culmination of basically, you know, Hans Gruber being accusatory and trying to take down John McClane, to sort of rattle him and undermine his confidence by just saying, oh, you're a stupid American cowboy. And, you know, he leans into that and is like, yep, that's me. I'm Roy Rogers. I like the sequin shirts.
Well, you know, in the effete versus the natural American themes of it, you have like Hans could be seen as this, you know, European film critic who's just like, you Americans with your stupid John Wayne movies. You do not know Francois Truffaut and his wonderful. And McClane's just like, actually, I was more partial to Roy Rogers. Not like that shit. How you like that, huh?
I think at some point in the movie, the terrorists are called Eurotrash.
Yeah,
I think by the cokehead guy. Yeah. I forget his name.
That's Ellis.
Mm.
Oh, Ellis.
Ellis.
Ellis has to toss off some racial lines, so you don't. Again, it's like feel too bad, audience, when he dies. Like he's bad. He's a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, his big introduction is he's sniffing coke in his office when the president walks in with Holly. So, yeah, like he's definitely not a bad guy, but also not a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't feel bad about losing him.
It's like how they build up the lawyer in Jurassic Park. So, like, you don't feel too bad the lawyer gets eaten.
Right, right. Lawyers.
And if he wasn't murdered, he might have killed somebody eventually, like American Psycho style.
I would assume that guy has at least, like, two vehicular manslaughters on his reputation.
All right, so the premise is of this movie, now that we've discussed it in depth, we can actually explain what it's about. John McClane, a New York cop, is heading to L.A. for Christmas to visit his semi-estranged wife and see his children. There is the question of like whether he's going to be able to stay at his wife's house. And, you know, when the possibility comes up, that's actually kind of like a pleasant surprise. And, you know, they get back together. She's moved to L.A. to work for this multinational Japanese Zaibatsu, and you know, she's risen up the ranks. She's clearly very powerful in this company. She's basically second to the boss, so you know, she's probably making a lot of money, so you can definitely respect the fact that she's there. But it's breaking up their home, and you know, once they actually get back together, they talk warmly for a few minutes, and then they have a big argument. And so the wife's name is Holly Gennaro, formerly Holly McClane, still technically Holly McClane, but she's not willing to reclaim that until John McClane has murdered a few Germans.
Mm-hmm. She realizes he's a great man then. And
right.
Also, I have to say the last name Gennaro feels like a screenwritery joke that she has no real identity without her husband's name. Like, we need a generic name. Gennaro. How about that?
You're right.
Good call. So she's working for the Nakatomi Corporation. Apparently the corporate logo for that was originally a manji, but the director was like, yeah, that looks too much like a swastika. So instead it's like the stylized samurai helmet, which is way, way worse, honestly. Like a manji is actually used in Japanese culture, not necessarily for this, but come on, a samurai helmet, really? Anyway, whatever.
Well, I mean,
it's America's view of Japan in the 80s.
That guy's got like samurai armor in his vault.
Yeah,
he's got everything in his vault.
He's a big samurai fan, it seems.
I mean, it's just how the Japanese are expressed in 80s movies. It's
on the whole, I think it actually treats the Japanese a lot more fairly than a lot of American movies in the 80s, because even though Takagi, I think, is the first to die in the movie, He is at least seen as a very reasonable man, very kind of very kindly, and he is willing to take a bullet for his team. Like,
yeah.
He basically does the I'm Spartacus thing, and he's like, you know, leave them alone. You're looking for me. I'm Takagi. I'm the boss.
Well, and you see he's not a full stereotype either, because like Hans reads his entire Wikipedia page out loud, and you hear that he's like, yeah, he was they mention internment in an American film. That was shocking to me to hear.
Yeah, and he goes by Joseph Takagi, so he's, you know, he's been kind of naturalized over here. He's not one of the bad ones. He's one of the good ones. Yes.
That's why, it's about how they portray victims right before their death. It tells you how they want you to feel. And, you know, they mention, like, his background, that he's a father of five, I believe, and they want you to feel bad about his death, much worse than you do about Ellis's death.
Yeah, Ellis is another executive at the company working alongside Holly. He's unctuous and slimy and does cocaine. One of the best jokes in the game is that he wants some coke when the terrorists or the villains take him in, and they get him a can of coke.
Oh, I didn't realize that was a joke.
Yeah, so great. Like when he dies, he's drinking coke. Because he's a cokehead, and they I think they don't understand that he means he wants cocaine.
I just got that now.
That's actually a very subtle and very funny joke.
Mm-hmm.
So those are kind of the people inside Nakatomi Plaza. Outside, you have Argyle. That's just his name, Argyle. He is a limo driver, very young, very fresh-faced. First time doing limo driving. He used to be a taxi driver.
He's
good,
him.
Salt of the earth.
I love Argyle. Like, he's great. He's funny. That's why they want you to care about limo driver too. He's like, well, it's my first day on the job, so you have to like him. You feel bad for him. And then when he's told, like, sit in a car for 8 hours, he's like, well, fine, I'm gonna drink everything in here and just call in sick to work.
I like this character, but there's a joke with him that I've seen in a lot of 80s movies, often with like a person of color, where like they're listening to their rap music so loud they don't notice that Freddy Krueger's on the loose or Jason's on the loose.
That's true.
It's such a weird joke that popped up 1,000 times.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if I, you know, were my first day on the job in a limo, it's Christmas Eve, and a dude is like, sit here in the parking garage for a few hours, and I had access to the mini bar, I'd be listening to my music pretty loud too.
I'd be blasting Run DMC as well.
Yeah. It was maybe great. Not Run DMC for me, but yes.
What a great, it's so great hearing Christmas and Hollis in this too. Yeah.
Now that's become a standard. Like
for sure.
Then it was like, can you believe this?
You don't even know what, it was.
This is Christmas music?
Well, I think for like the majority of middle America folks watching it in the 80s, they're like, this is just the rap sound to me. I don't know what this is.
Now 50-year-old mom singing at Christmas karaoke machines.
So there's another guy down on the ground, Sergeant Al Powell, who is played by Reginald Vell Johnson, who was a pretty big comedy star in the 80s. I mean, Family Matters was basically supposed to be his show until Urkel took over.
Yeah,
and Urkel took it in the 90s. Yeah.
I think it would be that show started in 89, and I was looking at his like resume. He played a ton of cops. Like, he's in Ghostbuster playing a cop. After this, he'll be in Turner and Hooch playing a cop. He played a ton of cops. And I have a real Pavlovian response to seeing him on the screen, because I watch a lot of Family Matters. Just like, I immediately like him. It's just like, oh, it's the friendly dad. And boy, that Steve Urkel's a pain in my ass too. I'll tell you what, buddy.
I mean, you see him with his, you know, he's balding. He's got a mustache and he just has this like friendly authority demeanor that does when he's a cop, you're like, I want to listen to this cop. This is a nice cop. Like,
he's a cop in Family Matters too.
He
That's
is a cop
that.
There too.
I was retconning this ending. The thing you find out about him killing a kid is like, no, he shot Steve Urkel in cold blood.
Yeah,
and it was a frame up.
And he was 31. 31 when he got cast in this.
Wow.
Like, yeah, he's looked the same forever. In the movies that made us, he's one of their key actors. They got and talked to him. They even take him by the old set, and he's like, wow, I remember this. These trees weren't here then.
And he reprises this role in the 2002 game. He's like the one person to come back.
One of the failings of the latter day Die Hard movies, I think, is that Powell as a character would not exist. He could not exist in those movies. Like, there's just no place for him. And to me, that's a big part of why they fail. Like, you've got to have this good salt of the earth family man to really make it work. And incidentally, his dark backstory about accidentally shooting a child was extremely ripped from the headlines. This is something that I was kind of recently reminded of when I put together an NES Works episode on the game Gotcha. You know, now we have toy guns have to have safety orange on them. But back in the late 70s, early 80s, people were manufacturing extremely realistic toy weapons, like semi-automatic weapons and Uzis and pistols and six shooters and things like that. And kids were running around playing with them. And there were a few incidents where policemen did shoot children who were playing with toy guns. And so that caused a huge, it was a huge problem in the US, like a huge point of debate. And that's why we have safety orange on guns now, because they were like, you know, you guys can't keep making toys that look like the real thing because we just have too much of a problem here. Even though we haven't actually addressed the actual problem, we did at least, you know, do what we could to keep children from getting shot because they were holding guns.
Well, it's all about the symptom, not the disease.
Now children get shot because they go to school and people bring guns into school, but that's, you know, a different story altogether. But I will say that at the time, his backstory was extremely like, oh, yes, okay, I've heard about this on the news. Like, it really, really grounded the character and put kind of a human face on this tragic rip from the headlines thing.
Yeah, it humanizes him in so many ways. Like, you really love him, honestly.
he's a big teddy bear, isn't he, folks?
Not different from the actual big teddy bear we see at the start.
Oh, that's true. There are two teddy bears in this movie.
But I think you made a great point about what fails a lot of the later diehards, other than the only other one directed by John McTiernan, which is The Vengeance. But it's that they are ensemble films. Like, this is an ensemble film. Like, he needs a great supporting cast of characters who can carry scenes without Bruce Willis in them, because they're all these scenes, just he's not in them. And when Bruce Willis has to be in all the scenes in every later one, it's just like, well, it's kind of, or they cast like Dennis Franz, who I like, he's just no fun. And two,
I haven't seen two, and I think I saw a lot of three on TV. It was on TV a lot for some reason. I know Reginald Bell Johnson's in two, and Samuel L. Jackson is a sort of like friend on the street.
Vengeance. Vengeance is a great film. Like, it is, it's also was,
I would say,
weapon.
It's the one real sequel to this movie.
And like Samuel Jackson Zeus, like, he rules. He is the greatest. And I think why it's also the only sequel is that, like, they have a taunting Euro trash villain in that one as well, which is also key to Die Hard.
And speaking of the taunting European villain, Hans Gruber is played by Alan Rickman,
whose
very first cinematic role. He is English, but he's playing a German very convincingly. There's a part where he does an American accent very unconvincingly that they actually wrote in because they were like, oh, he can do an American accent. Let's put this in. But it's a great scene that adds so much to the movie, where he and McClane meet face to face, and McClane has no idea who it is, but he's savvy enough that he doesn't set himself up to be quite as vulnerable as he seems.
As the audience is going like, don't hand him the gun, don't hand him the gun.
Yeah, it's a great, like, scream at the screen kind of moment. And both of the characters really live up to their, you know, their personalities there. Gruber says he's going to count to three before shooting and then pulls the trigger after one. But the gun is empty because Bruce Willis or John McClane is no idiot. So, great, great scene. And, you know, this movie made Rickman a star. Like, he was so, so calm and collected and so menacing, despite being, you know, not that imposing a figure on the screen. He's so smart and so ruthless. You really, really, Yeah, he's just a great villain, a great screen villain.
This is where the filmmaker Kevin Smith fell in love with Alan Rickman, because he put him in Dogma, and for the Clerks animated series, the villain of that series is just Alan Rickman, but he didn't want to come back and do Hans Gruber voice for Kevin Smith.
That's
so
true.
That's why it's Alec Baldwin in the Clerks cartoon.
Well, then it turned full circle, because Kevin Smith is in the fourth Die Hard movie.
That's right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Truly
Live Free or Die Hard?
I think that's the Jai Courtney one, yeah. And then Hans Gruber, like a million villains were just copies of him. Like he is a villain archetype that everyone ripped off. Like there's a Critic episode where it's just this plot. Like Homer in a Simpsons dream sequence, he's fighting a Hans Gruber type. John McTiernan in his parody of these films, Last Action Hero, he creates a Hans Gruber in that is so smart he can discover he is in a movie and can leave that movie.
That's awesome, yeah.
Yeah, which Star Trek ripped off for Moriarty.
Yes, yeah, it's
holodeck.
That holodeck Moriarty, the most dangerous criminal mind.
Was this the turning point in which they were moving away from the sort of Middle Eastern terrorist stereotype to like British-like and European terrorists in movies?
You know, I think it was being seen as more problematic than to do it, though not like, I mean, for example, in all the Golan and Globus films,
yeah,
they had very Arab villains in most of their movies. But I think it was starting to be seen as like, well, you know, let's have international terrorists and have a collective of terrorists. You know, it's like they all work together kind of thing.
So Die Hard, in conclusion, as the film, there's, you know, definitely some undertones where you're kind of like, I don't know about that in the year 2020. But on the whole, as just like a piece of beautifully crafted cinema, I really like it.
Well, part of Hans Gruber's plan was to blow up the building to make it seem like he died in the building. And presumably, the hostages were all going to die too, right?
Yes. There's so many, like, Hans Gruber's plot too. I love how he comes in and gives a speech of like, almost like a socialist speech of just like, your riches have made you evil and now it's coming back to get you, Mr. Takagi. And then when he's alone in the elevator, he was like, hey, that's a nice suit. I've got two of the same ones. Like he's showing how rich he is. But I guess one other thing I wanted to say just about the film itself that really struck me when I rewatched it last night was just how many swears there are in it. Like
it's a cussy kind of movie.
We're used to this kind of thing now, but I do feel like you compare it to other 80s films and they just like, fuck you, motherfucker, I'm gonna fuck you up. Like they say it so much. It was shocking to me watching it now.
Yeah, the R rating was fairly new when this was made too.
Yeah,
so
yeah, I think I blame
R had been around for a while. It was PG-13 that was pretty new.
Oh, that's right. That's what I meant. Sorry.
But this was way saltier than PG-13. I think in terms of violence, I think this would work. I think this would have flown as PG-13, but it had so much language and just a little bit of titty. But mostly it was the language that they had to do in R.
You know, that's another great scene in the movie that's about the characters where when he's having a fight with his wife in the beginning and they're like very cold and distant, then in come these young lovers in between them. And it shows even in more stark relief how messed up their relationship is. And it also, this film does hate sensationalist media and like literally punches it in the face.
And that's Holly's big moment. She gets to punch the media in the face. John doesn't do it. It's her job.
I have to say, this is a very tightly written script. I think we could have lost the like storyline with the news guy. It just felt like it showed up in the middle of the movie and there's a resolution, like, but we could have cut that a little.
The point of that was to give away, you know, John's relationship with Holly.
It's
kind of like the domino that tips at the end.
It's really great too, because you get a little of that tension with Ellis's character. You think he's revealed that Holly's his wife, and then it lets you know fully the stakes, and then once he finally finds out, like, it's near the end, and that, and also he's played by the asshole from the dickless asshole Ghostbusters.
Although
I didn't realize that. Okay.
He has a beard in Ghostbusters. So
there was some comedy there with him and the newscaster who hated him. I did enjoy that.
Yeah. Eat it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me you got that. On the making of thing, the actor says he was the one who came up. Tell me you got that.
All right. So final thoughts on the film. I think we've pretty much covered it, actually.
Yeah, no, I think like a perfect action film. It's not the I think there actually are smart themes or deeper things to dig into with what it says about certain viewpoints. But it's not if people remember on the RoboCop one, if they've listened to that Retronauts, I loved it on such a deep level with the themes it was discussing. This is not that deep a film, but like if I'm watching an action movie, this is one of the best I could possibly watch.
Yeah, it's very satisfying. It's never boring. And don't sleep on it like I did. I regret so many things now in my life.
Yeah, I agree. It's just a like it's a very satisfying film. And there aren't a lot of movies that I feel work on the same level as this. I am a big fan of 2006's Casino Royale because it kind of does the same thing as John McClane for James Bond. But none of the sequels really lived up to that. But yeah, you don't come across movies that work on this level too often. So they're worth cherishing and celebrating.
Oh boy, I can't wait for Future History 101 today.
I hear Prof. Timesworth is going to teach us about World War VI.
Gather round, students. It is time to learn.
Podford University, where history and future are the same class. Available on iTunes, Spotify, and everywhere you get podcasts.
Retrograde Amnesia is a comprehensive podcast where we relive a classic Japanese RPG.
Season 1 covers the cult classic Xenogears. In Season 2, we're covering Chrono Cross.
Each episode, we take a section of the game and unpack the story, mechanics, music, and themes.
And we have an AI companion, the FakeNet. It'll make sense later.
Find Retrograde Amnesia wherever podcasts are found.
On Apocrypals, we talk about the parts of the Bible that a lot of people skip over.
Like the wizard battles.
The angel jacuzzis.
A goat full of sins.
500 drunk elephants.
And a man named Porky Party.
And yes, that's all really in there. All this and more on Apocrypals every other week on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
Hey folks, it's Asif Khan, CEO, Editor-in-Chief, over there at ShackNews.com. Give a listen to the ShackCast, the official Shack News podcast of Shack News. Over there on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
So one thing that they are not worth doing, these fine films, is making video games about. Yet, because this was a big media property in the 1980s, late 1980s, to the NES era, and because this is a video game podcast, we are talking about the video games based on Die Hard. And what we can say about all of them is that they're not that great, and definitely none of them really capture the qualities of the movie that make the movie great. Like, you definitely have settings and characters that you will say, oh yes, like in the movie, but I just don't think that I don't think the industry was really there. I don't think it was prepared to make a movie that worked on the level that Die Hard, or make a video game that works on the level that Die Hard did as a film. And, you know, maybe that's just a difference in the medium. But have you guys spent much time with any of the Die Hard games?
Not until the late 90s, yeah. In the Sega-verse. I did not touch this NES one. Yeah.
Die Hard Arcade was the one I would, like, run to without even knowing the movie. It just was such a fun, like way crazier than Final Fight brawler.
Yeah, well, because in the late 80s, in early 90s, when I would rent an NES game, and I definitely ran in my fair share of poor NES games that were based on a movie, I didn't know Die Hard as a film, so I wouldn't rent it. Like, I rented Freddy and Jason and RoboCop and every Turtles game I could touch. Anything, the Roger Rabbit piece of crap. Like, I rented all of those, but because I didn't care about Die Hard when I would have rented a bad Die Hard video game for my Nintendo, I did not touch this game.
Yeah, so I feel like, you know, you're talking about Die Hard Arcade by Sega. That is by far the best of the Die Hard video games, but it's also by far the worst adaptation of Die Hard as a concept in film.
Oh, yeah.
So it's an interesting balance. Maybe Die Hard is just video game proof. But yeah, the NES version is one that I passed on because even at that tender young age, I had learned that movies based on video games were probably not going to be very good and that I should not bother. And so I was really surprised when I sat down with a game for, you know, to research for this episode, because it was not what I thought it was. I thought it was an Ocean developed game, you know, from the British studio Ocean, best known for their work on ZX Spectrum and many sort of mediocre to terrible NES games in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I thought it had, you know, Bruce Willis with a giant head. No, that was Hudson Hawk.
Oh, yeah. Oof.
The NES Die Hard game is totally different and totally weird. And it's actually really ambitious and it's almost good, except it's really not fun to play. But it's a top-down game in that sort of skewed 3D perspective that you see in the later Ultimas, like Ultima 6, Ultima 7. It's like everything is just at a really awkward, weird angle. But it all takes place in the Nakatomi Plaza, in the Nakatomi Building, and you play as John McClane. And there are a lot of kind of structural design elements that really mirror the movie. It's all very abstract. If you don't know the movie, it makes no sense whatsoever. But they've really kind of assumed that, you know, the audience of 11-year-olds who were renting this game or buying this game in 1988, 1989, had somehow seen this incredibly violent and dirty language filled R-rated movie, which is kind of a little bit strains credulity, I think. But it's a very interesting game. Did you guys spend any time with this at all?
No. In fact, I wasn't really sure what Die Hard was until I think With a Vengeance came out when I was in high school. And I was like, oh, that's what Die Hard was. I thought it was about car batteries.
I just watching the long play of it now, it is pretty interesting looking. I get real Hotline Miami vibes, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Except it's nowhere near as fast paced as Hotline Miami. And yeah. It's much more structured than Hotline Miami. Mm-hmm. So... okay, the way this game works is, yeah, it is a top-down view action game, sort of, like I said, that kind of weird skewed perspective that makes it hard to play, and it takes place across five floors of the Nakatomi Building. It's like floor 31 through 35 in the roof, and you can move freely between the floors, and you are John McClane, of course. You have a, you know, health meter, and you also have a foot health meter, so you don't want to walk across too many dangerous, damage tiles. But there are 40 villains, 40 terrorists, you know, Germans, basically, in the building with you. And they'll drop ammunition. You can move around kind of freely between the floors, including using the ductwork. And basically every, I think, 4 minutes, Theo unlocks one of the other locks. So you have kind of this countdown that's running, and you have to... basically complete all your tasks before Theo breaks the seventh and final lock. Although you can like shoot out the supercomputer, the main computer to the building, to slow him down. But time is constantly ticking forward and you're constantly being hunted. And it's really interesting because little windows will pop up where either Hans will, you know, tell people move to this floor. He's, you know, this in this place or this other place, or Powell will later call in and say, I think I see movement, you know, on the windows on this floor. Because after like the second lock, I think Gruber says, he's listening to us on the CBs. Don't talk on the CBs anymore. So then you have to get your messages from Powell. But basically it's kind of telling you like, here's where the guys are going to be. Here's where people like the heaviest forces will be. So you're kind of moving around, trying to find the key elements that you need on the proper places and the proper floors in the proper order. Including, you know, eventually like You can go up to the roof and pull the fire hose down, but if you go too early, McClane will just say, I'd have to be crazy to try to jump down on this thing. But then, you know, when you're escaping before it explodes, then yeah, that's what you have to do. There's kind of this internal architecture to the building where, you know, it's broken into rooms and there's a fog of war effect, you know, like a line of sight element where you can't see on the other side of walls. So, you know, when you're walking through a room, anything that's on kind of the other side of a wall from you is just black. Mm. So there can be villains there and you may not realize it.
Well, that's really good because when I was watching it now with the eyes of a modern day gamer, the movie, there's cover mechanics in the movie. Like he mm-hmm. is doing the Gears of War, you know, a cover.
Yeah, blind fire.
Blind fire. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have that in this game. It's much too simple. I guess primitive would be a better word. But I do think that there is something here that could be worked, you know, with refinement and modern sensibilities into a really good adaptation of Die Hard. This is not that. But kind of like with the game that they did based on Rambo, like Pac-Man Video, they weren't good at making video games. But I really feel like the people who worked there were like, let's do something interesting. And they failed colossally, but spectacularly. And so that's how I would define this game. It is a spectacular failure that really tries to capture a lot of the movie. And the tech and the design just isn't there. But you can really see what they were trying to do. And, you know, I don't think this game is fun to play. I did not enjoy playing it, but it's really fascinating. And so, you know, from that perspective, it's very interesting and one of the more ambitious film adaptations I've seen on an 8-bit system. Hmm. Also, Coke cans are a power-up, which is very funny.
That's, you know, that helps pay those bills, too. You get Coca-Cola to advertise in your game. You know, I meant to mention this earlier when we were talking about the actors, too, that that is not Huey Lewis in the movie. That is the actor Dennis Hayden, who just looks exactly like Huey Lewis.
Did we say he was Huey Lewis?
No. Okay. I wanted to, in case people still think, like, yeah, and Huey Lewis is in the movie.
Well,
like,
he was in Back to the Future, so he was just in all the movies, right?
Yeah. And I wouldn't say people should watch the Cleveland Show, but when they
not an endorsement, please.
But when they did their Die Hard parody, one of the funniest things they did was they recast that guy as Huey Lewis, and Huey Lewis does play that character.
All right, so Huey Lewis is not in that video game, no matter what. No one who looks like Huey Lewis is in that video game. But at least that video game did attempt to be faithful to Die Hard. Not so much the PC Engine game, which never came to the US. It was only released in Japan. It was also by Pac-Man Video, but it is nothing like the NES game. It is kind of a top-down shooter, but it's more like Commando, except you have, you know, instead of just scrolling up, you can scroll in lots of different directions, kind of moving your way around the scenery. You can also jump. You can pick up different weapons. It's a very chunky game, and it's very weird because it doesn't take place entirely in the Nakatomi building. It takes place, like, you have to kind of work your way there, and you'd, like, fight through a jungle.
Yeah.
Like, have you guys ever been to L.A.? Like, this is not L.A.
I guess we flew over the jungle on the way to E3 at some point. But, I was watching this video of the playthrough, and it starts with one of those, like, Castlevania-style world maps, like a side view of, like, your progress you're making. And, like, there's, like, a jungle and a river before the Nakatomi building.
That's so weird. There are no jungles in L.A.
I mean, I guess technically
it's an urban jungle.
It's a forest, but he's like, oh, there must be a way through this garden, which feels like a translation thing, but
that's insane. Though Bob and me have been very near the real Nakatomi Plaza because we at our Simpsons table read, it's on the same property. It is a building Fox owns that if you just go to a meeting at the Fox 20th Century Fox lot, you will drive by the Nakatomi Plaza, still there to this day. And I guess Disney owns it now, I guess.
I thought they blew it up.
No. It survived. It survived.
Okay. Anyway, the goal of the PC Engine game is to fight your way up through the skyscraper and then gun down a helicopter.
So you're killing the FBI guys at the end of the game.
Backtracking a little bit, there was a Commodore 64 adaptation of Die Hard, which was developed by Activision, but it feels kind of spiritually similar to the NES game. It's not a top-down viewpoint. It's more of a final fight viewpoint where it's kind of that three-quarters perspective and you around in, you know, on two axes. It has an entire inventory system that takes up the bottom of the screen. Unfortunately, I feel like this game is really constrained by the technology because the actual playable space is like a quarter of the screen, and then there's a huge inventory and a huge display at the top. So it kind of becomes almost abstract, but you are kind of working your way through the hallways of the office complex and trying to, you know, perform different tasks taken from the movie. But again, like the NES game, if you haven't seen the movie, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So you really have to kind of know the material, in which case, like, you know, kind of spoils the surprises. I wasn't able to play this one because I don't have a working C64, but it doesn't feel like I missed much of anything.
I hope you at least jump off the building at the end of this one, too.
I could not say. Like I said, I wasn't able to play it. Just watched some sample videos.
What I like about this one is, again, I don't have one of these Commodores either, so I couldn't play it, is that there's like a running kind of commentary at the top of the screen where people talk to you like Hans Gruber or Al on the street. Like, it's sort of like a kind of like very primitive Metal Gear kind of thing, although it's happening within the UI of the game itself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. That's cool. But yeah, it sounds it sounds far more ambitious than you could ever do on a C64. But I applaud any C64 game that did not do three quarters viewpoint.
All right, so we mentioned this earlier, and again, it's the best Die Hard game, the worst adaptation.
Dynamite.
And that is Sega AM1's Die Hard Arcade and its sequel, Dynamite Cop. In Japan, this was not a Die Hard licensed game. It was called Dynamite Deca, and it does take some weird liberties with the source material. It's a two-player brawler, so you're fighting a lot of terrorists. Most of them are wearing like 1980s colorful tropical jams and things like that. Or I think there's like a cyborg spider that you have to fight. It goes a little wild.
Yeah.
You also have a second character you can fight as a fight alongside of Chris Thompson. I don't know who that is, but she's there in Japan because this was not a Die Hard game. The main playable character is not John McClane. His name is Bruno, which is a nice little insider reference.
That's his jazz persona.
Yes, exactly. So definitely, I feel like this was made by people who really loved Die Hard and really were into it, but also were like, you know, let's not let the constraints of this film tie us down. Let's just make a fun as hell brawler, cooperative brawler in polygons. Like, you know, by the time this was made, it was like 96 or 97. Like that style of game was really fading. And it feels like they kind of just said, who cares? Let's do it in polygons and make it just like over the top and hilarious. And they even put in a little touch of movie love in that as you fight and play through the game, your costumes become more and more degraded because John's outfit takes a beating. Like, he starts out in a white wife beater. And by the end of the movie, it's like brown because he's been in the ducks and crawling around in soot. And it's all bloody. And that comes through in here. Like, by the end of the game, you're just like, you've got shredded pants, like high waters, and your shirt is all destroyed.
I love in the, just quickly about his costume in the movie, I meant to say that it's another thing I love about it is like, you, if you see a screenshot from the film, you know at what point of it is in his life because he changes throughout the whole film. Like, by the end of the movie, he is shirtless, barefoot, covered in blood and smoke and fire everywhere. Like, it's beautiful how they let you know what point you are in the film because of how Bruce Willis is costumed.
The continuity department really got their, they earned their paycheck on that one.
About this game, yeah. Die Hard Arcade or Dynamite Deca, whatever, some very important early roots of both Shenmue and Yakuza are in this game. Mm, and it's
yeah.
So there are QTEs in this game before Shenmue. And there are also, it has all of the crazy pick up any weapon you see on the screen thing of Yakuza. That's like, that was the most fun part of this game for me. It's like you can pick up brooms, you can pick up everything on the screen because they're all polygons. You can just whack people with them. It's great.
I love this game so much. I played this game to death. Like, because we had the Saturn version, my, you know, in my family, it was for that 32-bit generation, I could pick a system I'd get for my birthday. My brother picks the system he gets for his birthday. We were upper middle class kids who got
spoiled.
I know, but he picked the Saturn. I picked the N64. It was years before we got a PlayStation. But the Saturn, we were kind of stuck for games. But when we got Die Hard Arcade, we played it a million times because me and my brother, like, it was honestly, we were nostalgic while he was 10 and I was 15 because we wanted to play a new Streets of Rage, and his Streets of Rage is hell. Like, and so you just play it over and over and over again. And, just God, the brawling action of it. It showed me what brawlers could be when things get polygonal, but it's also why, like, brawlers, Sega couldn't keep making awesome brawlers in this style because it's way too short and arcades are dying. So they couldn't make them anymore, which is really too bad. But, and I mean, do you get, if you spent $50 on this Saturn game, do you get a lot of time for your money? No, not really.
It's about a 20-minute game.
Yeah, but, oh, man, we played that 20 minutes a million times. Like, yeah, I all the QTEs, all the terrible dialogue. Like, it also reminds me of the House of the Dead games with their terrible dialogue in it. And also, yeah, I love the characters so much in it. Like, in my line, if anybody else uses line, the messaging app, there are Dynamite Cop sticker sets you can get.
Oh, and wow.
I've sent many a Dynamite Cop sticker to friends and loved ones. I love that game.
And there is a sequel for Dreamcast. I wasn't able to play Die Hard Arcade because my Saturn recently died, but I did dig around with Dynamite Cop a little bit, and it's just dumb fun. And I feel like you mentioned Yakuza and Shenmue as kind of successors of this. I also think Spike Out, in a way. Wasn't that Sega also?
Well, Sega was doing, like, weird, fun brawlers in this era. Like, Zombie Revenge is one of those, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I played a shitload of Dynamite Cop as well, because I had become more of a hardcore online video game nerd, so I knew it was a Die Hard Arcade sequel, which, you know, got to be an annoying fun fact I could tell my friends, like, you know, actually, this is Die Hard Arcade. But yeah, I played that one to death too. That big fight on a boat at the very end with all the missiles and the God, good times. But that also was, I didn't think the Die Hard Arcade was too shallow to be a home console game. But when I played Dynamite Cop, I'm like, they really can't charge $50 for this. This is wrong. But yeah, you're so right. Yakuza, in the same way as Dynamite Cop, like, it's the evolution of the Sega brawlers that Sega was so good at, and they kind of lost that technology in a way, and were able to rediscover it in the Yakuza games because they couldn't make quarter munching brawlers anymore like the Dynamite Cop series.
Yeah, I just looked up Spike Out, and I was right. It was a Sega game, and it has very much the same visual aesthetic, like the same colorfulness and just overall vibe as the Die Hard Arcade series.
I should have played
it. And it was led by Nagoshi.
Mm.
It's like kind of almost arena-style brawler, like a blend between arena and traditional Final Fight-style brawler, Streets of Rage-style brawler. So it's kind of in between there. So I feel like there's kind of this natural progression. You have like Streets of Rage, Die Hard Arcade, Spike Out, Yakuza.
Yeah, like you were saying, Henry, in an earlier episode we did on Yakuza, that Sega doesn't make 30 games a year now. They just put those games into Yakuza.
Yes.
Like, the fighting element is this. Mm-hmm. Like an evolved version of this, rather.
Yeah, you're right. They used to make a darts game. Now the darts game is just a segment of Yakuza. And same with these brawlers. I just miss quarter-munching brawlers so much, but specifically Sega's ones. Like, I played Streets of Rage endlessly, but never touched Final Fight as a kid. And so I miss these types of games. And Die Hard Arcade was a wonderful 32-bit encapsulation of it. I love it so much that when I played, I mainly played Project Cross Zone and Project Cross Zone 2. So Bruno would join my team and I could see Bruno and
he's in it.
That's yeah. Awesome. And there's a lot of great localization jokes about Bruno in there that gotta give thumbs up to whoever wrote that game.
That's why I wanted to play that like Namco Capcom strategy RPG that I heard was terrible that never came here. I'm like, it's all my friends. Yep. All my friends are here. I don't care if their game is bad.
Project Cross Zone is the same thing, but also with Sega. So
well, that's okay. The Project Cross Zone games, the quick aside about them, they are ridiculous. They are bad. They're not fun to play. Like, they're, as a tactical game, as a tactics RPG game, it's not that fun to me, honestly. But getting to see the scenes of the characters are also just like the themed. Okay, the combat even sucks, but when you put different mixes of characters together, they do cool cinematic fights together And then plus they just have the funniness of like, well, what if Chun-Li met Pai from Virtual Fighter? What if all these these same archetypes from multiple different fighting games all hung out with each other and they're all like, oh yeah, we all are Chinese stereotypes, aren't we? or what if Majima met Jin Kazuya? Like, what happens then? And the writers have a ton of fun with it. Or even when weirdo characters that haven't been in a video game in 20 years meet each other, their music comes in and you're just like, oh, the lead girl from Sakura Wars is meeting the ninja from Virtual Fighter. Like, it's, you kind of, for me, I suffered through tactical RPG that I didn't particularly like just to see more and more of the fan service. And really, I guess you should just watch a playthrough of it on YouTube and just skip every combat sequence and you'll get the same feel.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Speaking of games that aren't fun to play, there's also Die Hard Trilogy for PlayStation.
You know,
by Probe Entertainment.
In your notes, Jeremy, you said you don't want to talk about it, but I have no experience with this game, but I've known people of my generation who really like this game, even though it's just like three kind of bad mini games. For some reason, there's a lot of love for it, I guess just from the PlayStation generation.
Yeah, I think it's those PlayStation dopes who didn't know there were good Japanese games that, but seriously.
PlayStation folks. Dopes.
No, I do think, the title took it a long way, and I knew some friends who liked it too. I was one of those, Japanophiles who was telling them, like, Die Hard Arcade's way better than this one. But I know that this came from the Fox Entertainment Publishing era of, like, when they made the video games themselves. So that's where Die Hard Trilogy comes from.
There were some bad.
Well, no, it was by Probe Entertainment. They recruited Probe, who did lots of really bad licensed movie games around the mid-90s.
Well, like Fox Entertainment was run by ex-Acclaim guys, so they know the bad people to hire.
That explains a lot. Yeah, because Probe worked with Acclaim a lot, so yeah.
Yep. Mm. Yeah. No, I
haven't played this in like 25 years, and it was only briefly then, but it sucked then, and going back and looking at it now, it is one of the ugliest games I've ever seen. It is just unjustifiably hideous. I cannot believe how bad it looks.
It's I'm wondering if there are even textures in this game looking at it now.
I think, you know, maybe it tricked kids with like the value proposition. They're like, by calling it Die Hard Trilogy, it's like I'm buying three games at once.
Yeah, now that I know about this, and now that I'm remembering how bad this was, I'm wondering if all the people who think Alien Trilogy on PlayStation are also completely wrong.
Oh, yeah. I think I know why this is so popular. It came out in 1996. There was nothing huge for the PlayStation in 1996 yet. I mean, that was
Resident Evil
and like Crash Bandicoot. That's when it was first starting to take off. So like, if you wanted to play like one of the five like interesting looking games at the time, this was probably one of them.
Fortunately, we've come a long way since then. And I want to end this podcast talking about one last Die Hard game that I've never actually been able to play, but I spent, you know, probably half an hour watching videos of it and just kind of reading about it and digging into it. and it seems like something I'd probably still enjoy, and that's Die Hard Nakatomi Plaza by Piranha Games, released in 2002. It is a very 2002-ass first-person shooter, but built around the Die Hard license. And so it just has that vibe of kind of a generic first-person shooter from 2002, which I kind of like. Like, I miss those games and wouldn't mind playing this again. It seems like it does an okay job with the license. It seems pretty short, too, like 3 or 4 hours long, so it doesn't overstay its welcome, which is nice. I don't know. It seems appealing.
Yeah, no, it does sound, but it's funny to think how few years separated in Die Hard trilogy and how much better it could be. And that they actually, you know, it doesn't sound like it was comparable to, say, how Activision hired everybody that worked on Spider-Man to be in the Spider-Man movie game, or how EA would hire every actor and be able to say, like, it's like you're playing the movie, every actor's here. But that they did go to the effort of hiring some of the people, the more affordable actors in it.
I don't know. Reginald Val Johnson, he's got to have almost as much money as Bruce Willis. If you're on a sitcom in the 90s for a decade, I feel like you're living in like a mega mansion or something.
That's true. Yeah, I think he just takes whatever jobs please him, I guess.
Bruce Willis is famously easy to work with, too, right?
Everybody loves him. He's a great guy.
I don't know if you're being sarcastic or not.
Oh, no, yes, no. He's notoriously awful to work with and just a huge prick.
A supreme prick known for being very difficult. And isn't he great in Pulp Fiction? He's really great.
I love him. Well, as soon as he lost all of his hair, that's when you can write him off.
Yes. Yeah. He did the reverse comb over. Like, he was one of the first guys I knew who were just like, I remember right around when Vengeance came out, he was on David Letterman, and Letterman's like, oh, you just shaved it all off. He's like, yeah, I held on to it for too long.
So anyway, Nakatomi Plaza seems really short, but I appreciate the fact that it seems to have lots of sort of non-combat goals, although it is way more combat heavy, you know, gunplay heavy than a Die Hard game really should be. There are a lot of things you can do beyond that. Like, you have a lot of objectives, cutting wires and things like that. It has, you know, the ability to kind of crawl through ducts with a lighter and sneak around behind the scenes. And there's some fun stuff, like there's an escort mission of sorts with Argyle. So it seems like they had fun, took a few liberties with the property, but still try to retain the spirit of it. So, yeah, I'm sad I missed out on this one. It was just a PC shooter, and as far as I can tell, it's never been reissued. I'm sure the license is too expensive. It'll never show up again. So it was kind of one of those, like, blink and you miss it things. But, as games of this era go, it seems very much like a product of its time, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, now that Disney owns Die Hard, you're not going to see those licenses anywhere for a while, I think.
Oh, yeah. When are we going to get Disney Infinity rebooted with a Die Hard module?
I mean, they are definitely going to make a new Die Hard movie at Disney. Bruce Willis will be doing these movies as long as he can, I have a feeling.
As long as there is HGH in the world.
Oh, come on. That's all. Let's not cast a spoiler.
Every 63-year-old man looks like that.
Yeah, exactly. He just lives in the gym. He works so hard.
All right, so that's it. That's Die Hard, the movie and the games.
Yeah.
Just the movie. We're not talking about the sequels because most of them are bad. And anyway, Die Hard was the one that was really influential. The others were just kind of, hey, let's do the Die Hard thing again with Bruce Willis instead of with some other cast. And this was one of those really sort of monumental films of the late 80s. I don't think it really was a huge hit at first, but it's just one of those that's kind of got caught in the collective craw of pop culture.
Oh, my.
And it's just kind of stayed there. You know, it kind of resurges every Christmas, basically.
Well, yeah, I don't want to talk about that aspect of it, but
it's a little tiresome.
But they make a great point on that documentary that I had not considered in a while. But for, like, after this movie, it was basically 10 years of action films that were all pitched as Die Hard on a boat, Die Hard on a bus, Die Hard on a, like, Under Siege, a perfectly cromulent action film. It's just Die Hard on a boat. Speed, a really, really great action film.
Yeah.
That's just Die Hard on a bus, you know?
I was also thinking, did Die Hard influence Kojima? And then I'm like, all right, there's a guy in Death Stranding named Die Hard Man.
That's also true.
Die Hardman, whatever you want to call him.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, the shadow this casts on video games, it's, I guess it's, it's probably as much as any other action film. The Running Man, I'd say probably more because it has like full on boss fights. But like the, I mean, like there's also like an ammo gauge in this and picking up guns and getting more. And
like, everything he picks up is useful. Like it, it will play off later in the movie or pay off later.
Yeah, and collectibles to pick up, all these things. So yeah, I think I can definitely see how this heavily influenced video games as well as all of those movies. And I said it before, but I love the cultural exchange of that American movie companies, for the most part, produced all these incredibly influential action films that all these Japanese game developers super got into. Then they make games heavily influenced by that. And then that comes to America. And then Americans develop games that are influenced by those games. Like it's just a really interesting cultural exchange to me.
It's the great circle of life. All right, guys, I'm signing off here from Nakatomi Plaza. So if you wouldn't mind radioing in where we can find you on the internet.
Oh, I guess I'll go first. Hey, I'm Henry Gilbert. Follow me on Twitter at HENEREYG. And, you know, if you liked hearing me and Bob talking about media and histories of them, well, boy, do I have a couple podcasts for you. Mm-hmm. There's Talking Simpsons, where me and Bob talk about a different episode of The Simpsons in chronological order once a week. And also our weekly podcast, What a Cartoon, where me and Bob and cool guests talk about a different animated series once a week. If you like Jeremy, he's been on several episodes, including our Bubblegum Crisis, our G.I. Joe, and our Max one. Those were all fun, and those are all supported. Well, you can hear them for free on the wherever you find podcasts, Talking Simpsons, What a Cartoon. But if you'd like to get even more stuff and cool bonuses and support us doing it, go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons to find out more.
So thanks, Henry, for doing all of that work for me.
Yes.
I could have done some of it. It's fine. I'm just on Twitter as Bob Servo. You can also find me on these podcasts as well, all over the place.
And finally, I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find me doing stuff every day at Limited Run Games, although a lot of that's not public-facing, at least not yet. But I do work there, and that's my thing that I do. And the other thing that I do is this show, Retronauts, which you can find on podcatchers everywhere. And you can also support us through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. If you support us, it helps us, Bob and I, pay our bills. It helps me pay people who contribute to our social media, do editing and cover art and run the website and so forth. We're kind of a multimedia empire. Yeah, it's true. And your support helps make that possible. So check us out, patreon.com/retronauts. If you subscribe at $5 a month or more, you also get exclusive content, including bi-weekly bonus episodes and weekly columns, written columns by Diamond Fight. And there's some other stuff that we're doing in there, some giveaways and some drawings and things like that. So check us out. Again, patreon.com/retronauts. And I think that's it. So, guys, I'm going to blow this building and shimmy down on a fire hose. So catch you later.